Welcome again. And it is really lovely to be here with you all. And when I use the word welcome, I want to just extend the welcome to all of you, the all the parts of you that maybe don't always feel so welcomed. And to know that if there's something that I say or don't say tonight that makes you feel less welcome or not quite included, then I would really ask that you say something to me if you can. Or maybe contact FIMC and then let me know that way. We're all these humans working towards non-harming, and so I just want to put that out there. So I'm going to start tonight with a quote that you may be familiar with. Returning hate for hate multiplies hate, adding deeper darkness to a night already devoid of stars. Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that. So that's a quote from Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And for those of us in the United States, this is Martin Luther King Jr. Day. So today I want to offer some particular reflections on understanding and navigating ill will, that is sometimes called hatred. And it might not be a surprise that there is significant alignment between what Dr. King had to say about this and what the Buddha and a lot of the suttas say about this. This is for me a pretty quote heavy talk. And I just would like to encourage you, if you haven't read or listened to some of the people that I'm quoting, including Dr. King, to really read or listen to like the whole speeches or the whole talks or whole books if you're interested at all, because you get a different flavor than just hearing these quotes that people extract. So ill will in Buddhism, or many of you may already know this, is one of the five hindrances that hinder our ability to see clearly and to unify the mind. But the word or idea of ill will is often used as a synonym for anger. And I really want to pull that apart for you some, because they are not the same thing. Anger, because it's so deeply connected with ill will at times, is given a bad rap. Because the energy of anger can be the energy of our agency or the energy of our protection. Whereas ill will has a different quality to it. And because they are not the same thing, when people talk in the Buddhist world about, oh, ill will is a hindrance and you need to work with it and get rid of it in a way, or somehow let it go, then sometimes that gives the feeling of, oh, your energy, your agency, the power that can come from the energy and the chemistry of anger, you're supposed to not feel that. And then that leads to a feeling of like, oh, so I'm not supposed to ha be able to act. Or I'm not supposed to be able to take care of people and help myself and others to not do or be harmed. So I want to really have a better sense of this ill will. And by ill will, I mean like wishing others harm or hurt. It's a cruelty of thought or action that comes up, and it can be super subtle. So sometimes if I'm using the word cruelty, it can sound like a big thing, like a big cruelty, but it can be really subtle. It can be as subtle as years ago when I took Upasaka vows. That's like a vow as a lay practitioner, just means I'm dedicated to the practice. One of the extra vows for that is to not take satisfaction in the misfortune of others. And so sometimes that is a quality of that ill will that we don't always notice. So it's not just these more overt kind of cruelties, it's also those more subtle ones. So I want to, right from the beginning, look at how ill will impacts us, because that sometimes is a way in towards this way of starting to say, oh, this is worth detaching from. This is worth letting go and navigating and figuring it out. So in the Anguttara Nikaya, which is one of the collections of the suttas, it says, suppose there were a bowl of water being heated over a fire, bubbling and boiling. If a person with good sight were to examine their own facial reflection in it, they would not know and see it as it really is. So instead of just using this term ill will and having some vague idea of it, you might even imagine a moment when you had a flavor of that ill will, and that it can have this boiling quality. It can have this quality of not being able to see yourself or others clearly. When you're wishing ill for someone or wanting harm for them or something bad to happen, it really is this question of, am I seeing clearly? Am I seeing the situation clearly? Am I seeing them clearly and myself clearly? So knowing that when there is that bubbling, it's not just that your own reflection of self is being distorted and not being able to be seen. It also impacts the way that you see others, you see a situation, you see the world, basically. Sometimes it can feel like, oh, that ill will is when I'm seeing really clearly. But hating yourself or hating someone else, that quality of hatred, it's already from the get-go, altering and distorting what can be seen. This is why it's called a hindrance, is because it makes it difficult to see clearly. So another place that this is described, it talks about it's being like a person who is ill or suffering or terribly sick with no appetite, weak in the body, and they might after a time recover and regain their appetite and bodily strength. But this is this illness, this sickness quality. And when you think of ill will that way, it might actually allow you to have some compassion, right? So it's not just that ill will is a hindrance. Ill will is something that is conditioned in us. And so we can have compassion for the conditions that let it arise in us, and perhaps have some compassion for it arising in other people. And again, I really want to be clear. I'm not saying that having compassion for this or having compassion for it arising in someone else does not mean don't act. It doesn't mean then everything is all fine and good. It doesn't mean if there's the bully on the playground that some adult shouldn't come in and interrupt that, because that's also a protection of the person who is acting out of ill will. I mean, I think about, I don't know if you have memories from your childhood where you carry a little bit of shame about something that you've done or that had that quality of ill will, and you wish there'd been an adult who could have stopped you in those moments. You wish somebody could have come in and been the adult. That kind of compassionate act towards ill will, is there can be a fierceness to it, but there can be something so kind about being able to act to interrupt these trains of ill will in ourselves or others. So another quote from Dr. King: we usually think of what hate does for the individual who is hated, or the individuals hated, or the groups hated, but it is even more tragic, it is even more ruinous and injurious to the individual who hates. You just begin hating somebody and you will begin to do irrational things. You can't see straight when you hate. You can't walk straight when you hate. You can't stand upright. Your vision is distorted. There is nothing more tragic than to see an individual whose heart is filled with hate. And Nelson Mandela said, resentment is like drinking poison and then hoping it will kill your enemies. So I'm talking about this in this way so that you have an understanding that there's some benefit to you, some large benefit to really starting to navigate ill will. And then again, to start to pull it away from the energy that gives you this impetus to act in protective ways. So back to the suttas. So too, when one dwells with a mind obsessed and oppressed by ill will, and one does not understand as it really is the escape from the arisen ill will, on that occasion, one does not know and see as it really is one's own good, the good of others, or the good of both. So I was in a conversation with a good friend and colleague of mine, Rebecca Renfrow Wilder, and we were talking about ill will and talking about how sometimes it can feel disordered or can feel like there's this meanness or it can have this almost funhouse quality because what's being reflected is distorted in some kind of way. But also how sometimes that feeling of ill will, when it comes up, it can have a feeling of rightness, like right and wrong. This really like dichotomous thinking. I'm right, they're wrong, us, them. It's a polarization. And it can be not beneficial to anyone when we start getting that polarity going on, those big polarizations. So some of you might know Reverend Angel Kyoto Williams. And she talks about anger in a different way than ill will, right? Because this ill will can bring this polarization, this us and themness, because we have this idea of I want them to hurt. But anger can be different. So Reverend Angel says, anger is capable of pointing us back to love. Surprising statement, maybe. It arises as a result of an offense to what we love. When we thread anger back through the core of what we love, the response can be fierce and powerful, but not consuming. This is a very subtle point that is often not understood, that we can, in fact, have fierce responses that begin from a place of anger about injustices and pain that are greater than any person or community should have to bear. But that anger must be taken and threaded through and anchored and rooted in what we love. When we anchor it in love and allow ourselves to also be cognizant of the suffering that we were experiencing as a result of the loss and pain and injustice, we get back to the place again that doesn't want anyone to suffer like we are. We get to the place where we don't want anyone else to suffer. We don't want ourselves to suffer. We don't want someone else to suffer. That's just like a propagation of suffering in the world. We might want certain actions and behaviors and systems to stop, but not because we want somebody else to suffer instead. So whether that anger might be arising in relation to our own safety or well-being, or the safety or well-being of other humans we love, or other non-humans that we love, or health and well-being of like the planet, the ecosystem, or communities that our heart is connected to around the planet, we can have this feeling of anger, but can you start to get a sense in your life The invitation is start to get a sense of where that turns towards ill will, where that anger turns toward ill will. Because anger itself can be really skillful. I've heard so many stories of skillful things. You know, some of the simple ones you hear are maybe like, oh, the child that's running in the street and the parent reacts. It's an anger, fear anger, but it can be fierce. It stops the child from doing something that's going to harm them. But there's no ill will toward that child. It's actually the opposite of ill will that brought that out. So there really is a place for this anger around anything that's happening that is a threat, or these systems of oppression, or these different ways that this anger comes up that is not fueled by ill will. I know that at least some of you that are here tonight in person have been involved in activist communities over the years, and that there can be a difference when that activism, that movement is coming from a place of shared, basically a shared love and care for something that needs to be protected, as opposed to an ill will, like a hatred of something. There can be a something that can feel subtle or like a finesse to this, but once you have seen it and experienced it in your life, you can start to notice it and support it in yourself and others. I do want to name, although I'm not going to spend a long time on it in this talk, that sometimes the anger that comes up is coming up because of a misperception. Right? So we feel an anger coming up, and it's not really a protection. It's not really something else. It's because there's some misperception about what's going on. And kind of an odd example. I'm hoping this is an example that makes sense. So I ride my bike around, and years ago I was riding my bike, and somebody who was driving by in a car screamed in the car, which when you're on a bike, it's super startling to have an unexpected sound, and it can cause, you know, like the wobble and all of this. And, you know, at that time in my life, that the first thought was like, WTF, why are they yelling at me? You know, blah, blah, blah. And I mean, immediately it was like anger and ill will, like immediately in the same thing, like I wanted to blame them for having done this thing. But the reality is, I don't know why they screamed, right? And my patterned thought went immediately to that it was towards me, it was about me, it was against me, and then it had to do with something, but I don't know that, right? And because I was holding on to the idea of that and then holding on to the ill will, it lasted. You know those stories that you tell over and over again to people because you're just like, I'm just going to tell it again and again, and I'm so right, and there's, you know. But I don't know. I don't know all the causes and conditions that led to that moment for that person, led to that moment for me. So there's a book called You Belong by Sevin A. Selassie. I see at least one person here knows the book. And in it, she tells about how she had a lot of difficulty with George W. Bush. And ill will. And she didn't want to have that ill will, right? So she wanted to work with it. So what she did was she started doing this thing where every day she would spend 10 minutes every day imagining his life basically from conception, imagining every aspect of his life from conception, everything she knew about him, everything she would think might happen to him. And she started this from a place of thinking, if I were where he was, I would do something different. But through that practice of really exploring his life in that way, she realized if I were in his exact place, if I had had his life, I would be him. I wouldn't be me in his place. I would be him because of all the conditions that led to that moment. So there's ways that we can have again, like the energy that comes up from like, oh, some of the things that that George W. Bush did, I'm pushing against, but I don't have to hate him for it. I don't have to have ill will towards him, because then if you follow that really to its logical conclusion, you have to have ill will and hatred towards everything that led to him existing on the planet. You can't just decide, oh, I'm going to hate this person in this moment, because so many things from the beginning of the beginning led to each of us being here in this moment. And I don't hate everything on the planet. I don't hate water and, you know, the good healthy gut bacteria, or, you know, there's lots of things, you know, that I don't hate. But then, like, wow, I have to then decide that I'm going to have ill will towards all of that. Because you can't isolate this. We are not that disconnected. We are completely interconnected. We could have a whole talk on, in Buddhism, this like dependent co-arising, how everything is so interconnected. And when you really can get that, then you can see how, like, if I have ill will towards one aspect of this, then I am in some way ill willing everything, even though it may feel like that's not what's going on. So a while back, I sat a retreat with Mary Aubrey. She's a student of Lee Brazington's, who was a student of Ayakema. There's a whole line. And she shared this really, really lovely story about driving with her granddaughter. Another bike story, apparently. Driving with her granddaughter and a bicyclist cut them off, right? And so then Mary did what she had to do to not hit the bicyclist. But then they come to a light, and they could see the bicyclist and at the stoplight ahead of them. And the granddaughter, who was fairly young, was just so angry and just saying all these things, and obviously saying things related to ill will. She was having so much ill will about this bicyclist and this thing and this thing. And so Mary said she was so grateful for her practice, because she turned to her granddaughter and she said, "Who's suffering?" And so her granddaughter said, "What?" And she said, "Who's suffering right now?" And she said, she felt so much like grandma pride, like grandma, like, ah, because the granddaughter said, "Oh," and got it. That's a grandmother to have. Mm-hmm. That's a grandmother who's like cutting you off in the ill will in a way that's coming from love. So what are some other ways that we can start to catch this ill will early on in the process? Like the precursors to ill will. So again, in the suttas, it says, "Bhikkhus, I do not see even one thing on account of which unarisen ill will arises, and arisen ill will increase and expand so much as dislike. For one who attends carelessly to dislike, unarisen ill will arises, and arisen ill will increase and expand." So it's like when we feel that dislike, that is like an early signpost of like heading towards ill will. It doesn't mean you don't dislike actions, that you don't dislike things that are being done that are harmful. It is especially around the dislike of people that leads to ill will. Ill will, I think, is much less often expressed towards like a tree or something that's growing. Ill will is actually generally expressed towards other humans, include or not even other, or ourselves. We get trained up in that way. Dislike can really sound like innocuous, like kind of like, oh, I dislike this or I dislike that. But really, if you see it as a thing that is a step on the road to ill will, to that strong aversion, then you can start to notice it earlier on and catch it earlier on. So because sometimes the feeling of anger that comes up that then I'm going to stop for a second before we go there. Okay, so when we want to try to catch the ill will, we can maybe go back and know, like in the Buddhist tradition, there's a whole understanding of the way that things arise, right? So there's some kind of input through the senses generally, and including mind scent, there might be a memory or a thought. Something comes in through the senses, and then there's immediately this vedana, this labeling of pleasant, unpleasant, or neither, right? That's still kind of like a neutral thing. It's just something that happens. It's part of like amoebas do that, right? They say, oh, pleasant towards, unpleasant away from. That's how survival happens, right? We get a conditioned version of that, you know, from our families of origin, from our communities, from bigger social systems. We get a conditioned version of what is likable and unlikable. And then that version of what is pleasant, I mean, or unpleasant, then is what contributes to what we think of as disliked. Oh, and then I don't want this. And then we get the aversion. And then we start trying to push things away and manipulate things. And so then anger can come up in really great ways. And anger can come up in this way that's conditioned that doesn't really make a lot of sense. So like I mentioned earlier, that can come up in a misperception kind of way. But if we kind of know the train, oh, there's an input, then there's this vedana, this pleasant or unpleasant. And then there's like, maybe then we can attend to what happens next. What happens after pleasant or unpleasant? Well, we can develop all kinds of things after that. We can then get like, oh, frustration, or oh, all kinds of stories. So what we want to know is like, what's the trail that leads to ill will? So if we're just feeling some frustration, we don't have to go to ill will. We can notice it and catch it, potentially. Like here in Flagstaff, if you live on a street that is plowed, sometimes, especially this last year when there was so much snow, you got the berm in front of your driveway. So the plow would come by, look out the window, and it's not just this light, fluffy snow. It's like ice from the road and it's heavy. And so you kind of go out, and if you can, you go out and you're starting to shovel, and you can shovel and just like, it's like carry water, chop wood. It can be like that, or it can be like, that plow guy, and he did this thing, you know, and that changes your whole experience, right? And so then you could catch it, though. You can go, oh, seeing the berm, noticing the unpleasantness potentially of that. And then, okay, what happens next? Oh, there's some frustration. Okay, you know, and then the frustration is just a chemistry. It's just an energy. Anger is just a chemistry. It's just an energy. So I can use the frustration to get that snow moved, but I don't have to then turn it into a big story about the plow driver, or why did that person get this and I got that. And, you know, we don't have to get into the stories that are ill will related. We can start to see the danger of that and stop it earlier in its tracks. Okay. Yeah. I need to end up here soon. So sometimes I do want to say, though, that I've mentioned the word love in this context, and especially in that quote from Reverend Angel. And Dr. King said this other thing: love is something much deeper than emotional bosh. Love is something much deeper than emotional bosh. So when if we're doing a metta or a kindness practice, and we're doing phrases, may you well, may you be kind, that can turn out to be emotional bosh. It can just be a rote thing. But when we can deeply engage in practice, deeply engage in this, and deeply engage in the understanding of anger, then something else can come from that. We can get like a more robust love, a robust anger. Okay. Two more quotes and I'll be done. So David White has a really interesting paper on anger. He says, but anger truly felt at its center is the essential living flame of being fully alive and fully here. It is a quality to be followed to its source, to be prized, to be tended. An invitation to finding a way to bring that source fully into the world through making the mind clearer and more generous, the heart more compassionate, and the body larger and strong enough to hold it. It's kind of this way of understanding anger in a completely different way, as an energy force and a life force, right? And it's pointing towards often like something that's important. All right, so I'm going to end with Maya Angelou's Touched by an Angel. We, unaccustomed to courage, exiles from delight, live coiled in shells of loneliness until love leaves its high holy temple and comes into our sight to liberate us into life. Love arrives, and in its train come ecstasies, old memories of pleasure, ancient histories of pain. Yet if we are bold, love strikes away the chains of fear from our souls. We are weaned from our timidity. In the flush of love's light, we dare be brave, and suddenly we see that love costs all we are and will ever be, yet it is only love which sets us free. So let's just sit for a moment.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.